Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. The relationship to work has changed since the pandemic. A new form of job slowdown, quiet quitting, is as effective as the general strike. We'll find out more about quiet quitting. We have a comment on the March 5th raid at the South Forest in Atlanta, where a combat veteran who knew Tortajita comments on the raid on the bouncy house. Nashville SWAT kills Mark Capps, the Grammy Award-winning recording engineer. But local TV changes their story when they earlier reported that a Tennessee Bureau of Investigation officer was inside the house hours before the swatting occurred. Music by Capeton Live in Zaire. Norfolk Southern, the disaster in Palestine, Pennsylvania. We look at dioxin's history and the corporations who have capital control in places like Pennsylvania, Atlanta, Bhopal, India, and Jonestown, Guyana. Prisoner testing of dioxin at Holmesburg Prison, Pennsylvania in the 1960s. The culture of secrecy goes far beyond the blue wall of silence. Dow Chemical was never prosecuted for Bhopal, India, where thousands died overnight from a chemical leak of lindane when a $15 valve leaked in the night, killing thousands. Then and Now from YouTube tells us about cultural, political, and social guides that have disappeared and replaced by the market, that appeal to the limbic part of the brain, the race to the bottom, and addictive technology. We'll take a look at the blood trade in France, Germany, and the United States. Market liberalization of the donor systems. Blood plasma is more valuable than oil. What are the risks to the donors who live in poverty? And what are the new epidemics? Professor Mattel talks about her new book, The Capital Order, The Emergence of Pure Economics, and the disappearance of class conflict. Then we finish up with Jonestown, Guyana, home of the original Proud Boys. The People's Temple was built on property formerly owned by Union Carbide. The U.S. State Department never warned a California senator who was killed on that airstrip in 1978. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G.
The pandemic caused a lot of people to reevaluate their relationship to work.
My life's work isn't selling software.
Can you all stay an additional 10 minutes? I really want to go over something in regards to next week's meeting.
Do you know what this company needs to burn down?
What?
What?
And as it turns out, a lot of folks are fed up with the way things have been going.
Say you're a low-wage worker in Gen Z, right? Your first experience of the workplace is realizing that your boss doesn't really care if you get sick, as long as the burgers get flipped. And it's no wonder that you're seeing a lot of, you know, Gen Zers making videos about quiet quitting.
My mom's Gen X, my dad's the boomer. When I came to them, like in the pit of like my burnout, when I was really just distraught and really depressed, I came to them and I was like, is this just the way that it's going to be the rest of my life? It's just like, yeah, that's the way it goes. That was the moment where I was just like, and you all just live like this?
Gen Z has taken a look at the working world and decided the status quo is unacceptable. Surveys have found that Gen Zers are less likely than prior generations of workers to go along with long hours, overbearing bosses, or a lack of boundaries between the personal and the professional. The Center for American Progress labeled Gen Z America's most pro-union generation. All of this adds up to a real wave of worker dissatisfaction bubbling up from Gen Z. And there's a lot of content being posted about it, which seems to really resonate, even across generational lines.
I want to add to that discourse, trying to liberate us from a life of servitude to companies.
Catherine Berry, who goes by the handle Catherout, posted one of the most popular YouTube videos on this in 2021. In her blog, she explains why she no longer aspires to have a career.
Your employer does not care about you holistically. They care about your labor.
I am 26. I grew up in the Bay Area and went to college for business, after which I ended up working in tech sales in the Bay Area for about 5 years. I just have always been an overachiever. How do I outperform everyone and win this game, basically? So when that's just sort of the culture that surrounds you, it's really natural to adopt that and just internalize those values and think, okay, the best thing you can do with your life is to just achieve, perform, until someday it all just came crashing down. I put so much value in this thing that ultimately, not my ruin, but really, really damaged me and my health and my well-being. Attaching your worth and your value and your belonging and well-being to a job is not going to be your salvation. Like, we need to find other paths out of here and find ways to rebalance our lifestyles and ultimately, liberate ourselves from what can be ultimately really soul-crushing.
Motherland is calling, can you try your tears? I guess I'm calling. you dig too. One for women, one for you. Ooh. You gotta be careful, cause there's a lot of dangerous things out there. Hey, I tell my friends so you can't be safe. Yes, I can go on and on and on.
They're so terrified of these criminals that they have to go and target literal children and clear a fucking bouncy house to look cool. Look at our cool clearing jackets. And that is how you get those motherfuckers. You make the world see how ridiculous the entire idea and essence of having police is, because it's the weakest, bitchiest motherfuckers that exist that get into that role. And they're not there to protect anybody other than themselves and work their job, because they're submitting to authority and oppression just to do it. And you respect those people to protect you from authority and oppression. No, who's going to do that? The people who are out here and don't have to be, because they're the ones that are actually here for it. And that's all I want people to leave on. You know, justice for Tortuguita, to defend the forest, stop Chop City. Tortuga vive, la lucha sigue. We will fucking win.
I'm Don Aaron with the Metropolitan Nashville Police Department. This is a critical incident briefing concerning this afternoon's fatal police shooting on Summit Run Place in Hermitage. SWAT officers had been called to the home to assist in the arrest of 54-year-old Mark Capps, who was wanted on warrants issued this afternoon, charging 2 counts of aggravated kidnapping and 2 counts of aggravated assault for holding his 60-year-old wife and his 23-year-old stepdaughter in the home at gunpoint during the night. The victim said that Capps awakened them at 3 a.m., gathered them in the living room at gunpoint, and refused to allow them to leave. They said Capps repeatedly pointed his pistol at each of them and told them multiple times that if they attempted to call anyone, he would kill them and would kill any police that showed up at the house. The victim said Capps ultimately fell asleep, giving them the opportunity to flee the home with their pets. The arrest warrants were issued just before 2 p.m. SWAT officers had been made aware of the case.
Tonight, the music industry is struggling to comprehend the death of a Grammy-winning recording engineer. Mark Capps was shot and killed yesterday by a Metro Police SWAT officer. Thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Carrie Sharp. We do want to tell you, we will show you the body camera footage of this shooting to help give you a clear picture of what exactly happened. News Channel 5's Araceli Crescencio sat down with one of Capps' longtime friends who says this is a loss he is struggling to process.
It's outrageously impossible.
The odds of being struck by lightning or dying in an airplane crash are low.
That's a great picture.
And still musician Michael Spriggs says he would believe that over the reality he's living in now.
It's so unbelievable that this could happen.
His longtime friend and at one point chief engineer, Mark Capps, was shot and killed by an MMPD SWAT officer.
I mean, that guy was so gentle, so kind, I can't even imagine him having a crossword with anybody. And I worked with the guy for over 30 years.
Police say arrest warrants were issued against Capps after he held his wife and stepdaughter at gunpoint, threatening to kill them if they called anyone. They got away after Capps fell asleep and went to the Hermitage Police Precinct for help. Hours later, SWAT officers were at his door serving those warrants.
Show me your hand! Show me your hand!
A confrontation that lasted seconds and ended with Capps dying.
It all happens this fast, right? He goes, "Let me see your hands, let me see your hands." Bang, bang, bang.
Capps was well known in the music scene in Nashville. He worked with country and gospel artists, including Brooks and Dunn, The Chicks, Alabama, and more. Friends say they want to know if any de-escalation tactics were used.
We don't certainly don't understand how that could go in that, you know, just like that, you know, 2 seconds from show me your hands to dead. It's done, and it cannot be undone. We won't be able to make any more records with Mark. That's not going to happen. We're not going to have that magic anymore. That's gone. All of that experience is gone.
In Nashville, Araceli Crescencio, News Channel 5.
We have reached out twice via email to Metro Police to get any other possible angles of the body camera video, but we have not heard back yet.
And it goes like this. Are you seeing me? My black like a star. Black in town, I often know who you are. Black like a star.
Hey, Africa is a motherland, big up for black superstar. Black Microsoft. Black and I'm proud, I have to know who you are. Every time, yes. Sometimes when you see black post, you can turn back. Some said nothing good never come out of black. Take like us back, I say him too black. But my complexion could have never stopped. I'm proud to be black, I'm black to be proud. My first Gavin lead out 10 million black. I'm black to be proud, I'm proud to be black. I ain't feeling no one to shout about it, shout about it, shout about it, shout about it. Black like a star. Africa, in Africa, yes. Break it down, no bum.
So we are in the press box of the East Palestine High School Auditorium. The last of a three-day event with national political figures coming through here. The first being Trump, the second being Pete Buttigieg, and now Aaron Brockovich.
I can't tell you how many communities feel that these moments are the biggest gaslight of their life. Because you experienced it. You have symptoms. But you're going to be told it's safe. You're going to be told not to worry. But that's just rubbish.
This is all happening as the Environmental Protection Agency takes over the next phase of the cleanup process. In practice, that means that Norfolk is still leading the day-to-day operations, while the EPA monitors their progress. But the EPA plans to use its powers to force Norfolk to foot the entire bill for the cleanup. And if the company fails to finish the job, the EPA will do it themselves and invoice Norfolk for 3 times the original cost.
I want you all to know that we are holding Norfolk Southern accountable for putting this community in harm's way.
The EPA has a spotty track record of showing up, rushing to say everything's fine, then leaving people without the support they really need. We saw it in Flint, and we're already seeing some signs that it might be happening here. Recently, the EPA said that their own testing showed that the air and water near the crash was completely safe, but Texas A&M researchers, using the same data, found elevated levels of 9 pollutants that could be linked to serious long-term health risks. For residents, all of this can feel like a repeat of how Norfolk Southern has been handling the response in the last few weeks.
The fact that they gave Norfolk that entire responsibility was beyond me.
And that's the uncomfortable truth. No one really knows what the long-term health effects of all of this will be.
When you burn vinyl chloride, it forms dioxins, which are itself their own very hazardous form of chemical and are very, very persistent over long periods of time.
That's Emily Jeffers. She's a senior attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity. We asked her about the EPA stepping in and what they can realistically promise residents.
What are the full costs and how long will it take us to know what they really are?
That's a good question because no one knows. It's going to be years and years and years before we really understand the full cost. A lot of these cancers don't manifest themselves right away, so the harm that folks might see is not going to be readily apparent. The best case scenario is that Norfolk Southern pays a ton of money to these folks.
They owe us property value. They owe us our health. They owe us 5-10 years from now when things are going on.
I just don't know how these people can't have any type of, like, sympathy. Bust out the checkbook, man, and start paying people to clean this shit up the right way.
East Palestine residents have already taken it upon themselves to file multiple lawsuits against the company. But Norfolk Southern is counting on the cost of this cleanup to barely impact their bottom line. The thing is, they actually plan for catastrophes like this. And if they're lucky, they can even profit from them.
911, what's your emergency?
Yes, ma'am, a train derailment in Granville.
Train derailment?
Yes, ma'am, it's something blowing off all over the town down here.
In 2005, Norfolk Southern fought accountability for a similar disaster that they caused in South Carolina, which killed 9 people and led to the hospitalization of over 500. The company was ultimately forced to pay $4 million in fines to the federal government and over $10 million in settlements, a far cry from what was needed to cover the actual harm inflicted on that community. But now, investors on Wall Street are pointing to this example as a reason why Norfolk Southern's value is unlikely to be impacted by the disaster in East Palestine, and why now might actually be a great time to buy Norfolk Southern stock. It's important to remember This isn't some huge conspiracy. For companies like Norfolk Southern, destroying an entire town like this is just the cost of doing business.
This company town? That's owned by J.P. Morgan, Vanguard, and BlackRock. Alan Shaw is a pawn. He's a pawn. He makes $8 million a year.
Yeah.
$8 million a year. He lives in an 8,000-foot square mansion. Okay. He doesn't care about the people.
This area, the one that I grew up in, has been dealing with polluting industry for a long time. There's a picture from 1981 of a person in a hazmat costume protesting the construction of the nation's largest hazardous waste incinerator. That person is my mom, and the incinerator is just down the road from where the train derailed in East Palestine. Contaminants from this disaster are being burned off there right now. Heavy polluters have always been in Columbiana County, and for the longest time, it felt almost impossible to speak out against them. The Norfolk Southern disaster was big enough to shock people out of their political corners and raise questions about how business is done. How do you measure profits and stock prices against the value of people's lives, against clean air or clean water and soil? Can politicians really take money from corporations and be expected to hold them accountable? And who is the government for, anyway?
And I just feel like we're screaming into the void, and it really, really, truly does. I wish it wasn't up to us to have to do everything ourselves. Like, I mean, I just want to go back to, like, a normal life and do the stuff I want to do, like, not just try to figure out how to, like, avoid this, like, chemical apocalypse right now.
It takes a lot to go toe-to-toe with a $55 billion company, and I think that company is counting on people to return back to normal and to not speak up about it and kind of let whatever happens to their town happen to their town. But those people are clearly set on taking a different path, and I wish them all the luck in the world, which they will need. Norfolk Southern can get bent, get bent, get bent, get bent.
All right, if I say spice, you say written. Spice?
I love you.
Let's go. I'm right.
At the end of the 60s, Leotis Jones was a prisoner here in Holmesburg, a suburb of Philadelphia in the United States. A prisoner, but also a guinea pig for industry, like thousands of other inmates.
H-flat. This is where all the medical tests and the human experimentation was going on.
How many times have you taken that corridor?
Maybe 25, 30 times. You know, but there was different tests that they was running. And sometimes I was on like two tests at a time, you know?
Okay.
This practice was confidential at the time because multinational chemical companies came here to test the risks of their products. To earn a few dollars, the prisoners participated in several tests, but none of them knew what they were being given.
What they would do, they would put the tape and stick it and pull it, stick it and pull it, stick it and pull it. Then they would put a drop in the substance, whatever it was that was in it, on that area.
And what happened after?
All over my body, my skin pigmentation got light in certain areas. And they had you signing a paper stating that it was informed consent, but it was just a paper to waive them from being liable if anything go wrong.
One company did everything they could to keep this a secret. They even paid Leotis Jones for his silence. Dow Chemical. The leading manufacturer of plastics in the world and the third largest manufacturer of pesticides, Dow Chemical has an annual turnover of $48 billion and 50,000 employees around the globe. In the wake of this chemical giant, there's an industry of staggering profitability. Each year, their new toxic products reach the market. These multinationals all have one thing in common, a culture of secrecy. Polluting lands, rivers, and groundwater. Behind the fumes of these factories, we have discovered tens of thousands of victims. In India, children are born with severe disabilities. In the U.S., those who have dedicated their lives to this industry are now paying the price.
Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. Why'd they lie?
Faced with these tragedies, the chemical giants have adopted a specific course of action. Lack of transparency, cynicism, denial. In the meantime, they continue to reap the profits. In Holmesburg Prison, Dow experimented on the inmates with one of the most carcinogenic products in the world, dioxin. It's one of the molecules in Agent Orange, the powerful herbicide that Dow produced for the American Army during the Vietnam War. The Air Force dumped it on the Viet Cong for a decade. At the same time, the tests were being performed at Holmesburg. From that time on, Dow was already aware of the dangers of dioxin. The company put it in writing in this confidential note from June 1965. Dioxin is exceptionally toxic. We found one of the doctors that performed the tests at Holmesburg in the 1960s. Today, he's an oncologist at Northwestern Hospital in Chicago. Sigmund Weitzman is preparing to retire. He is one of the few witnesses still alive.
Every day, I had a row of 20 convicts. They were coming in all day. Okay. So
all day long, people were coming in?
Oh, absolutely. It was a machine.
In 1967, Sigmund Weitzman was only 21 years old. He was an intern at Holmesburg. The senior physician overseeing the tests never told him the names of the products used on the prisoners. He only realized later that he had administered dioxin to human beings. We show him what Dow knew back then about the chemical.
This cereal is exceptionally toxic. No wonder it's confidential. This is 50 years old.
Yeah.
Very upsetting.
This is the first time you read these documents?
Yes. I'm appalled. It's so casual. I also felt personally guilty that I was participating in something so horrible. You don't give people poison. It's just simple. You know, as if these people aren't people. They're just experimental animals. Nowadays, it would be criminal.
Here we go. That's a few minutes. You got your confidence first if you want to make it. Oh my gosh. Mm. got to confidence to fail if you want to make it one. And motivate to fail if you want to break it. Yes, then you gotta be no crook. Oh no.
Was never prosecuted. When prisoners tried to take action against the company, the statute of limitations had expired. This multinational would not only poison inmates with dioxin, but also tens of thousands of people in Midland, Michigan, in the north of the U.S. Midland, the birthplace of Dow.
Here at the Dow Chemical Company in Midland, Michigan, revolutionary chemical killers.
This is where Agent Orange was manufactured. Its production created waste extremely high in dioxin. Dow secretly dumped this waste into the river that flows through the city. In 1981, one man would discover the truth.
We had a conclusion there that Dow was a major source, if not the only source, to the river, and certainly to the community, and that people were at risk.
At the time, Milton Clark was a toxicologist for the EPA, the government agency responsible for environmental protection. With his colleagues, he wrote a report condemning Dow's practices. But right before the report's publication, the corporation would succeed in pressuring the acting chief of the EPA in Washington.
We went into shock. We had never heard of such a thing being done, ever. That the company that we were regulating, they would have the right to review a report, comment on it before it's released. And it was critically important to say that people were at risk, but they did not want that. They just basically want to squash the report.
Okay.
And eventually, the final report, they prevailed. And so they truncated it down and removed critical sections, and all the conclusions were taken away.
Pressured by his superiors, Milton Clark was forced to censor the report. The result, pollution in Midland, Michigan, would continue for 30 years with impunity. And the executives at Dow would continue denying the dangers.
There is no health problem in Midland.
There is absolutely no evidence of dioxin doing any damage to humans.
In 2006, one woman would attack the multinational again. At the time, Mary Gade oversaw all the offices at the Environmental Agency in the Midland region. She had leverage. She'd been nominated by the President of the United States, George W. Bush. Newly appointed, she demands that more testing be done in the city.
We found these astronomically high levels of dioxin, levels that my staff think may be some of the highest levels ever found in the United States. One of the things that was astonishing to me when this came to my attention was that for almost 30 years, this very serious problem had not actually been addressed.
Where have you found these high levels?
So yeah, we found it in yards alongside the river system, parks where children play, where people launch their boats, where fishermen put their boats in the water. This is where people live. So I immediately called Dow senior officials and said, we're very concerned about these levels. We need you to take action. As that unfolded, the company was not happy. It's extremely expensive to clean up this much contamination, hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more.
To lodge a complaint, Dow goes directly to the White House.
I was asked on May 1st of 2008 to either resign or quit by the end of the day.
Okay. Were you surprised?
Yes, very much so. In my 30-some years of working in environmental protection and much of that spent in the government, I would have never expected that. Dow was acting in its own interest, so Dow was trying to make sure that it saved as much money as possible.
As a result of these maneuvers, for decades, thousands of people have lived surrounded by dioxin without knowing the risks. We wanted to meet these victims. But in Midland, it's hard to loosen tongues. Dow has supported the city for 120 years, and reminders are at every corner. At the bank, the stadium, the library, the public park, the high school. Decaying steel site is still accessible today. Here we meet Mr. Shuan, a former engineer. At the time, he was in charge of the storage of the chemicals in this laboratory.
So what are all these bottles?
This quality control lab was full of the chemicals, bottle, drums, and after 32 years, still they are lying
Is that dangerous?
Yeah, it is dangerous because there's no proper care of this premises.
Among the products stored in the factory, there was lindane, an extremely toxic insecticide. Today it is forbidden all over the world. According to our guide, the soil surrounding the factory is full of it.
This whole area is highly contaminated, and this is the local pit. They're dumping all toxic waste effluent on the ground. Right now you can feel the smell of the benzene hexachloride on this spot. And it is dangerous to stay here for a long period.
Benzene hexachloride is the scientific name for lindane. We go down to the area of the spill to take some samples. The smell is unbearable. We'll have the soil analyzed. Just before leaving, Mr. Schwann shows us where the pesticides were made. Here, beads of mercury lie exposed in the open air. According to the World Health Organization, this is one of the top 10 most dangerous chemical products in the world. We take some more samples. The results of our two tests are astonishing. Inside the factory, the level of mercury is 5 million times higher than the environmental standard. At this level of concentration, the risks of developing liver, skin, or lung cancers are considerable. The levels of lindane are just as alarming, exceeding 100,000 times the standard level. This can provoke severe cases of cerebral degeneration. Yet only 20 meters away, we see children playing cricket on the contaminated ground.
Hi.
Hi.
My name is Raja.
Do you often come to play cricket here?
Yeah.
Yeah, but do you know that's a chemical plant that is dangerous?
These children come here every day to play on the land near the factory. They don't seem to realize the risk that they are exposed to.
Why are you playing inside the factory and not outside?
The chemical contamination stretches far beyond the walls of the factory. Toxic waste has penetrated the land and has polluted the water of many neighborhoods. Up to 3 kilometers from the factory, 50,000 people live there. We went to take water samples to identify the molecules present in their wells. Like in Shakya's family home, they've lived in this house for almost 30 years. The water they consume contains 1.9 micrograms of mercury per liter, 2 times the standard level of toxicity.
Thank you.
other areas of Bhopal. It's not mercury, but lindane that wreaks havoc on human lives. This is a problem in Preetnagar, a neighborhood situated 1 kilometer away from the factory. The municipality has had drinkable water since 2011, but for many years, the inhabitants have been drinking severely polluted water. That's the case for Rukmani and her 13-year-old daughter, Rachna. Since her birth, she's suffered from limited mental development and muscular dystrophy. She can neither talk nor stand up by herself. Rukmani, her mother, drank contaminated water every day during her pregnancy. A few months after Rachna's birth, a governmental study was conducted in the area. The levels of lindane were extremely high in the water, 17 times the World Health Organization limit.
Did you know that the water you were drinking when you were pregnant was full of pesticides from the factory? What's going to happen to Rachna now?
Due to her disabilities, Rachna has never been able to go to school. Every day she comes to the Shingari Rehabilitation Center. Without these daily exercises, she would be completely paralyzed today. Rashida B. is the founder of the center. She has watched all these children grow up. In 2015, Dow gave $4.5 billion to its shareholders, but not a single cent has been given to the decontamination of Bhopal. For weeks, we tried to reach the communications department at Dow to get an interview, without success.
The water that people drink. Who's going to answer those questions? It's pretty important.
I'm not aware of who that is right off the top of my head. We have 50,000 employees, so I'll have to do some research.
Dow never called us back, so we decided to go to the company's General Assembly in Midland, in the U.S., to ask our questions.
Need a break in life to show you now what she can do. She's conscious and polite and ambitious too. And she's so deep and she's so quiet. She only wants someone to keep her warm. And she's a warrior, she's a champion. Just for a chance to see what she can do. The sister gets her girl. Your mother takes the system. Not the conscious mind of the young say I forget her girl. Okay. Getting back to business. Yes. You see, I tell you about this little young lady, you see? You're out now. Isn't she? She never leave your side. She never go away too far. Together we can ride any time. Together we can win any war. Keep hold on to your pride. Know that you can be a star. Know that you can strive. I know you know the way to stay alive, and let's forget for now. Your mother takes the system, not because it's mine, it's just for now, forget for now. Girl around, the coolest girl in town,
Historically, we had authoritative guides about how we should act. They came from places like the church, from cultural ideas of things like masculinity, what acceptable decorum might be, what should or shouldn't be allowed on television and radio and so on. But those cultural, political and social guides have largely disappeared and been replaced with the market. At their worst, those cultural jigs, as he calls them, restricted us, but at their best, they provided a kind of landscape, an ecology that guided us.
In replacing them with the market, we leave ourselves open to whoever can attract our attention as the highest bidder with the sweetest, most addictive hook. And that's dangerous. When it comes to traditional addictive substances, tobacco, alcohol, drugs, we intervene in their use in several ways. By limiting access, by restricting by age, or say by regulating their ingredients to make sure they're safe. We do the same for casinos and gambling and for advertising drugs and other addictive substances. We also have cultural and social expectations and media pressure to make sure substances are made and sold responsibly. In liberal societies, both are meant to be a light touch. Adults should be left to make their own decisions. But I think there is legitimate reason to regulate when addictive technologies are affecting the most vulnerable. Regulation and our expectations of platforms like social media should be designed to protect categories like children and addicts. In Algorithms of Fear, Vail Gonim writes that we're not driving people to content that could help us as a society. You can build algorithms and experiences that are designed to get the best out of people, and you can build algorithms and experiences that drive out the worst. It's our job as civic technologists to build experience that drive the best. We can do that. We must do that now.
This is one of the biggest problems with giving in to the race to the bottom, limbic capitalism, dangled digital sugar in front of everyone's eyes of neoliberalism. The cyber ecology becomes full of addictive hooks that we have no protection against.
Recently, I keep coming back to this quote from the sociologist Zygmunt Bauman. He writes, "The deep contradiction of our age is the yawning gap between the right of self-assertion and the capacity to control the social settings which render such self-assertion feasible. It's from that abysmal gap that the most poisonous effluvia contaminating the lives of contemporary individuals emanate."
To fight that poisonous effluvia, we must take back control.
Thank you as always for watching, and a huge thanks of course, as always, to my Patreons, without which this just wouldn't be possible. So if you want to see scripts, if you want to chat in the Discord server, if you want your name in the credits, but most of all, if you just want to help support, make this content, then click the link in the description below. If not, you can like, you can share, you can leave a comment, all those things that help the algorithm. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.
Welcome to the wonderful world of blood donation. Around the world, giving blood is seen as a symbol of generosity, one of the noblest acts in modern society. But the reality is different altogether. Health is also an industry, and blood donations are subject to the laws of the market.
Healthcare is the perfect money-making industry. Our willingness to pay for available therapies, basically, especially for our loved ones, knows no bounds.
At the heart of this business, plasma, a yellow liquid rich in proteins. It's the main component of blood. It's more expensive than oils. We decided to explore a little-known area within the health industry, the blood trade. Our investigation took us to France, Germany, and the U.S. More than 100 million donations are collected each year worldwide. In 2015, The Swiss Red Cross registered 311,000 donations. The figure diminishes each year and they're constantly seeking new donors. Their message is clear. Giving blood saves lives.
Get closer.
Oh, no, it's a long time I've been here. Been so long. And I know that my friends and families are here. So, you know, we don't want to leave you hanging. No time at all. Can you see me? I know me that. They couldn't do that, we can't. Love got the powers like a flag flowing eyes of a castle. No matter what color, race, or class it may be, flowing through me like a roaring river, crashing through the mighty sea. It's burning at one man's red, find the greens. Girl, I know me that. True love is a fire, real love is a fire. True love is a burning flame. I don't mean that, me couldn't do that, I can't.
After the economic crisis, donations soared in the USA, going from $15 million in 2007 to $32 million in 2014. Luke Schaefer is a sociologist at Michigan University.
When we look at the numbers of families reporting cash incomes below $2 per person per day in any given month, it well more than doubles over a 15-year period. And when we look at the number of families who are on food stamps, it actually quadrupled. Emergency food assistance goes through the roof. So when all of these things are pointing in the same direction, so if we walked into the plasma clinic down the street and just asked people, why are you here? What's going on? People lost their jobs, haven't been able to find work. You know, in many cases, it's going to be the only income coming into the household. It's their only option.
The plasma fractionation industry. These are the pharmaceutical companies that buy 80,000 liters of plasma from the Red Cross each year. The humanitarian institution makes nearly 10 million Swiss francs from this sale.
What if you could earn extra money while doing something great for others? At Octapharma Plasma, you can. Not only are plasma donations vital to the treatment of rare, chronic, and genetic diseases, you could also...
The USA is the world's main exporter of human plasma with 70% of the world market. Their success is based on a foolproof recipe. By building on this type of campaign, they nurture the image of a country with excellent sanitary conditions. The market is under the supervision of the Food and Drug Administration. The FDA stamp is a guarantee of quality, opening the doors to the international market. Each week, frozen plasma is dispatched in shipments, mainly to Europe. This is the other side of the American dream. Masses of poor people willing to sell their blood. They provide an unlimited pool of primary material. We wanted to understand the conditions in which blood is collected. 7 a.m. in Cleveland, in the parking lot of Octapharma.
I can't do it no more. Best y'all ask the other people. Anyway, I blacked out. I don't want to do that no more. I just small, and I didn't eat before I went in, but it almost killed me, so I don't want to do that no more. I got a job.
I'm providing your product. You know, I'm like a cow. I'm giving milk.
These stories illustrate the industrial pace and inadequate checks. However, Octapharma assures the authorities that there is strict donor monitoring. But if that's the case, Why didn't the Swiss company let us enter? Why did they prevent us from talking to the staff? How are its donors selected? To check, we had to go and see for ourselves with a hidden camera. This is what we discover inside. Machines interrogate the donors. The volunteers answer the medical questions at electronic terminals. One single physical examination, measuring blood pressure. This is mainly to avoid the donors fainting while donating blood, which would slow down the entire chain. Not a single chair in the room is empty. An endless stream of donors with no time to recover after the donation. 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. In view of such summary checks, everything is based on what people say. Paid donations entail a certain risk. They encourage donors to lie about their health. Such compensation also attracts a high-risk population that sometimes has secrets to hide.
Management just advised that they want you guys to advise of trespassing, which means if you walk onto the parking lot, they will have their security sign charges against you guys for trespassing.
Okay, that's fine.
Very good.
That's fine.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you very much.
Back in Switzerland, there are many questions about compensation, exploitation, and concern about donors' health. Does all this affect the drugs we use? What control do we have over imported plasma? First of all, we wanted to see Tamara to show her our images. The Swiss medic experts reassured us that the plasma for Swiss drugs didn't come from paid donors.
Thank you! Yeah, that was done by our brother Joseph here. We are good friends in Virginia. Yes. Awesome. Things are getting harder, harder, harder. One word, harder, harder, harder. Things are getting harder, yeah. They cannot take it harder.
Things are getting harder.
And you know, before we go, you know, I got to play something for the farmers. I'm going to pick up all the farmers there because without the farmers, there'll be no food and no table. Every time, so, you know, the farmers, the atmosphere with it.
In industry terms, the money paid to donors is compensation, not payment. A play on words. In Germany, for example, donors may receive a small fee, which is limited to 3 times a month. But the fees offered in the USA are much higher, enough to let the poorest survive. The industry hides behind the trade secret, keeping the authorities in the dark. The socialist congressman, J.F. Stiert, is an expert in the Swiss health system. He finds the pharmaceutical industry's lack of transparency unacceptable. Opacity, profits, lack of monitoring. To what extent is public health at risk through this system? What threats does it pose to patients and donors? Jean-Daniel Tissot, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine of Lausanne University, has long been head of the city's blood center. Although he was generally reassuring, he pointed out the risks. Zero risk doesn't exist, as we are reminded by the scandal of contaminated blood that hit Europe, including the Swiss Red Cross and France. However much the WHO may state the importance of self-sufficiency, the world market isn't following. The USA is exporting more plasma, and soon Europe won't be able to do without this cheap raw material.
In many parts of the world, they've made decisions to, and particularly in Europe and several countries, some Scandinavian countries, France, are making decisions to basically privatize or to move into a private management of these types of donation systems.
Despite the checks being in place, the experts cannot rule out the possibility of a new virus. This fear for healthcare is a main feature of the news in France. In July 2015, Octapharma obtained the liberalization of the market. The Swiss company was authorized to sell its plasma and the drugs derived from it to all French hospitals. Until then, the French blood center had had the monopoly. This intrusion is worrying Michel Monselier, the director of the powerful Federation of Volunteer Donors. Market liberalization, increased sanitary risks. What does Octapharma have to say in response to these fears? After many months of investigation and countless requests, the company still refuses any interview. We went to their headquarters located in Lausanne, in the canton of Schwyz. Upon the police's request, our cameraman left the premises. The head of communications asked us to ask our questions in writing, promising us he'd pass them on to the shareholders. Clearly, nothing is decided without the approval of Marc Guerre, the founder and single owner of Octapharma. The company doors closed to us once more. We had a long list of questions, not only with regard to the sanitary risks, but also the company's methods. On the plasma market, Octapharma isn't the most important player, but its sales have already reached 1.5 billion euros and are soaring. Its business practices have often roused the authorities' suspicions. At the end of 2015, the former Portuguese Prime Minister was arrested for corruption. He allegedly received funds from Octapharma when he was a consultant in Brazil, where the Swiss company was involved in a huge case known as the Blood Vampire Scandal. Octapharma is suspected of bribing Ministry of Health officials. The case has still not been judged, and the company continues its activities in Brazil. Such political connections are worrying the French Donor Federation. Monselier has first-hand experience of the Swiss company's sensibility over this matter. When we visited the headquarters, Octapharma promised answers to our questions. A few weeks later, the head of communications informed us that none of them would be answered, without explaining why. There was only one solution left. Travel to Heidelberg, Wolfgang Marguerre's home. So our questions will remain unanswered. The origin of the plasma, its payment, the risks linked to donor poverty, drug detection, and the likelihood of new epidemics. Why doesn't Octapharma provide any answers to the questions of Tamara and thousands of patients? On Cleveland sidewalks, these questions seem derisory. selling their plasma will always be a lesser evil to those with no choice. Long as people in Europe and elsewhere need plasma, the pharmaceutical industry will meet their demand.
Down.
No, we ain't gonna stop now. Yeah, that's why don't stop. Brand new spanking again. Here we go. Sneak preview. Yeah. Right. Now the music play loud. Nobody turn it down. Reggae play loud.
under the sun.
Under the sun.
Let the music play loud, play loud, play loud. Nobody turn it down. I'm gonna play loud, play loud. In a drum down.
In a drum down.
Yes. Give me a little drum, give me a little beat, give me a little greeter. Tune up the sound and make it play a little greeter. The rhythm is so nice, I want you to put it on repeat. Now leave it on time and I leave that scene, yeah, wow.
Everything is a big corporation out here. Without money, nothing moves. You see, when the market crashes, everything shuts down. No government checks. So what can we do? Our plasma might still be running. Let's go get a couple dollars out of them right quick. Tap this arm real good. Let's give them what they want so we go get what we want.
Mark was relieved. He could finally give his plasma, and he received $20.
We're not safe here anymore. No one can deny the obvious. That is, there is an empire in my
the classical political economy perspective of someone like Smith, Ricardo, and Marx that sees the world as made up of, sees capitalism as a unique economic system made up of class conflict in which the source of value is the worker and surplus comes from unpaid labor. Well, this framework is completely substituted at the end of the 1800s, so, and in the beginning of the 20th century, it's just really emerging, with this novel framework, not of classical political economy, but pure economics. Classical economics was at the time, very intelligently, called pure economics, exactly to expel the political element from the very title of the discipline. And instead of classes and conflict, pure economists were seeing a world made of individuals and harmony, and a world in which the world capitalism disappeared. magically, we shouldn't be talking about capitalism anymore. We should be talking about markets, because capitalism was, in these models, completely naturalized to the point that you weren't even discussing it as a unique socioeconomic system. This is really, really the key, right? So first of all, that the battle was being played at the level of academia. So my protagonists are people like Maffeo Pantaleoni, one of the founders of this, also what is known as the marginalist revolution. And he was in Italy, and he was, you know, colleague of Vilfredo Pareto, Valra, Jevons, all names of the founding fathers of the neoclassical framework. Pantaleoni was fighting an academic battle because he was, in fact, he had purchased with the help of the wealthy, the Giornale degli Economisti, so the main journal, and was trying to get rid of the historicist school that in Italy, for example, was dominant until that moment. But here, the whole point is also that this academic battle had enormous political consequences, because it is this new model that justifies exactly what you pointed to, that justifies the fact that the wealthy are entitled to extract resources from the majority and keep it to themselves. How? Well, while classical political economists were pointing their finger to the worker as the engine of the economic machine, all of a sudden, it is the saver investor who takes on the leading role in the economy. At that point, you can become saver investor if you're virtuous and if you're a good individual. There's no classes. Everyone can make it. Those who make it at the top are because they are actually gaining in favor of everyone else. So, of course, the only rational policy here is austerity, because it's austerity is all about shifting resources from the majority to the minority. So we see here how austerity necessitates theory to back it as a type of state-led policy. So this is why theory and policy go hand in hand, and they reinforce one another. And you need both in order to convince people that there's no other alternative but appropriate the majority, how, again, privatizing, cutting social welfare, repressing wages, all in favor of increasing the profits of the few, and experts who tell you, look, we have nothing political. We are pure economists. We're using mathematical models that are absolutely beyond class bias. We are the most neutral and trustworthy. You people, you're just too ignorant to understand economics. Leave it to the experts. Now we have all internalized the idea that any economic decision should just be left to the experts, because we're too dumb or we're too ignorant. So just leave it to the Fed officials, leave it to the people leading the Treasury. Actually, this again was not something normal, was constructed in a moment in which people were demanding a greater say in decision-making processes, in which central banks were about to get nationalized so that it could actually become a matter of political choice if you were going to increase the interest rates or not. Well, it is in that moment that experts were all about, no, we need independent central banks. We need to preserve decision-making, because we are the only neutral, intelligent, knowledgeable parts of society.
Yeah. woman. My doctor drink it and him smoke it and him try to make him sober. Burn it in the pipe at times, burn it in the whistle. I see the devil is only pressing on the side to get weaker. Come on, I'm burning all the water. Something with you. I believe in planting a tree because it's only good for the development of the environment. Every time I tell you something about that tree, one man plant before you see, and it goes like this. Yeah, this. Let's go, girl, listen here. Here we go. Let's go. Break it down. Hear me.
Anniversary of the Jonestown Massacre, the mass murder-suicide that left more than 900 followers of cult leader Jim Jones dead in the South American country of Guyana. Congressman Leo Ryan was in Jonestown with a small team investigating the cult's activities and was shot and killed by Jones followers. But one of his aides on that trip, Jackie Speer, now herself a Democratic congresswoman from California, survived, and I spoke with her recently about her harrowing experience.
As more and more criticism started to come out about sexual abuse and physical abuse and money laundering, he then took about 900 of his members to Jonestown, where he had been building a commune for about 2 years. And concerned relatives came to Congressman Ryan. There were defectors who also came and told him of really untoward things happening at that compound. And the congressman wanted to find out what was really going on. The State Department was basically telling us there really wasn't a story there. There really wasn't anything to talk about. And unfortunately, we found out something very different.
You went there, you sensed in a very short period of time that something was terribly wrong. And then as you were leaving with some people who were ready to defect, some of the followers of Jim Jones came and shot to death, five people, and you were badly wounded, shot five times. Jackie Speer, how did you get through that? You lay there on the tarmac and then climbed into the baggage compartment on this little plane. No medical care for...
No medical care for 22 hours on that airstrip. For a long period of time waiting for the lights to go out, and when they didn't, I vowed myself that if I survived, I would never take another day for granted, that I would live every day as fully as possible, and that I would dedicate my life to public service. But it was a long, long, long process. I came home on a U.S. medevac plane. I then was in surgery for 2 months. Had gas gangrene. They thought they were going to have to amputate one of my limbs, and then survived and ran for the unexpired term of Congressman Ryan and lost.
Very quickly after you got out of the hospital, in fact, you were running for Congress.
And it was, you know, it was mostly emotional therapy. I wanted to not be a victim or just a survivor of Jonestown for the rest of my life, and it was a way of fulfilling his legacy. But I lost, and it was one of the three losses professionally that I've had that were really the first steps to really moving forward in my life. So the book talks about lots of loss and then how I've gone from heartache to healing.
How is Jackie Speer when you're there?
She's alive, very glad to be alive. She's had her share of traumas dealing with the months that have transpired, the frustration with the lack of support and action by the State Department, by our U.S. Congress, and a lot of support from family and friends.
How's your health?
It's improving. They have just 3 weeks ago found another bullet in my right arm, which they will be operating on in early December. And hopefully that will be the end. If I find another one, I'm certain I will be manufacturing them, I can assure you.
Right after it happened, in the month or 2 months after it happened, big hue and cry, the Senate was going to investigate, the House was going to investigate, the Justice Department, the grand jury, special federal grand jury in San Francisco, the California State Attorney General's office, and nothing's happened. Nothing. Not indictment one, not report one. I have been told by a very reliable source that the California State Attorney General's office has completely closed its People's Temple investigation.
I plant a little tree in my front yard. Precious little tree in my front yard. Who is the right for the tree? Some said the seed are found upon the wise man's tomb. I take it and I spread it in a loom. Pray to God for it to germinate soon. Nothing in this world like the high grade, not a challenge. And I'm a challenge. High grade, not a challenge. And nothing in this world like the high grade, not a challenge. It makes me feel so fine. Boy, nothing in this world like the high grade, not a challenge. And I'm a challenge. High grade, not a challenge. And nothing in this world like the high grade, not a challenge.
As one who was at Port Kaituma Airport that day and saw your boss and a very good friend die along with a number of other people, how do you feel about that?
It's very hard to deal with it because, you know, I walk around now with the scars and the baggage of that tragedy, realizing, was all of this for naught? Did these people die in vain? Did the U.S. congressman who was assassinated, the 900 people that died, did they all die in vain? Because our country, our government, is afraid to really look at itself and look at precisely why all of this happened, what they did wrong before we made that trip, and what went wrong during and after that trip. it leaves me cold.
A week ago came out that there was a significant amount of warning given to the customs agents, and they told it to our customs department. They told it to various and sundry branches of the United States government, the Justice Department, the FBI, well in advance. 1977, as a matter of fact. Nothing was ever done with that information. Do you have any idea why?
The State Department, for one, was totally irresponsible in their actions before we made that trip. We were never, ever warned about the dangers we might be encountering down there. The State Department, after the fact, made the statement we were, and after I made a statement that indicated that we were not, then all of a sudden they retracted their statement. But as a matter of truth, and that's what we're dealing with, there was never any kind of warning. Even though they had documents indicating there were guns being smuggled into that country, that there were drugs being smuggled in, and there were all kinds of other criminal activities going on, I can't understand why, except that there was a lot of politics. There's a lot of politics involved in our embassy's activities with the government of Guyana. 91% of the bauxite, the world production of bauxite, comes from Guyana. I don't know to what extent all of this was being weighed, but certainly it was.
Locally, there was a lot of politics involving Guyana,
absolutely,
too.
Absolutely.
There are rumors running around that there may finally come some, very, very soon, some indictments against Mark Lane, Terry Buford, Tim Stone. Do you see that as any kind of a sign? I mean, admittedly, they're just rumors.
Mm-hmm. It may have some impact, but I'm more concerned about the American tragedy in all of this. I mean, I have a personal tragedy that I'm dealing with, but there's an American tragedy. The American people cannot depend on the State Department or the federal government when they go abroad in terms of protecting American citizens abroad or in getting valid information, truthful information from their government when parents of loved ones who were down there, who were concerned about their welfare, who thought that they were being held against their will and inquired upon the State Department for information and couldn't get anything. Well, you know, they're happy there. It was clear upon our arrival there that there was mind control being utilized there, that there were people there that were there against their will. There were 40 people that left with us, were being held there against their will, or else they wouldn't have left with us.
Tim Carter has told Steve Davis that he places the blame for everything that happened in Jonestown and at the airport, right squarely with Jim Jones himself and with Tim Carter. You think that's valid?
I think, you know, the situation at that point in time was desperate. Certainly Jones would be responsible for a large part of that. He also injected in the minds of his members of his hierarchy the sense of destroying anything that might destroy them. And so you had Larry Layton and others, you know, coming after us at the airstrip.
Have you been called to testify?
No, I have not, which I think is significant in and of itself.
I mean, you haven't been called. You were there. You saw what happened, yet you have not been called to Guyana to testify against Larry Layton.
I had direct contact with Larry Layton upon our getting aboard that truck, upon making arrangements for the seating on the various planes. He kept coming up to me, wanting to make sure he was on the first aircraft. All this kind of contact. I have not been called to testify.
Do you know of anybody else that escaped the massacre at the airport that's been called to testify? Charlie Krause, Bob Flick, anybody?
No, none of those. So Vern Gosney, who was one of the defectors who left with us, has been called to testify, but he's the only one.
And do you see anything in that? I mean, do you make any suppositions based on it?
Well, as an attorney, I've got to question how thorough their investigation is or how thorough that trial is in terms of what they intend to prove relative to Layton's guilt or innocence, if they're not going to call on key individuals to testify. Not that I would enjoy the prospect of going down there to testify, but I still feel very strongly that, you know, there are people that have to be brought to justice in all this, none the least of which, of course, is our State Department.
Another thing Tim Carter said was he refuted the statements he'd made earlier about being a double agent. He said that wasn't his purpose for coming to Berkeley shortly before November of last year.
Now, clearly in my mind they were. He came and feigned that he was a defector, that he had left Jonestown. He wanted to know all the specifics about the concerned relatives going down to Georgetown, about the congressman's congressional investigation. And then, you know, a day or two before the party was leaving, he disappeared. I spoke with him at the commune then the following Thursday, Friday, when we arrived, and asked him about that. And Charles Gary was sitting there and said in all of our presence, well, he didn't sanction the actions that Tim Carter had taken, but Tim Carter said, well, you know, there are double agents on both sides. He says the defectors are doing it too.
That would seem to indicate the possibility of an American of a conspiracy taking place in the United States, which in all its taking of testimony, the federal grand jury just either has been unable to or just can't come up with.
It would appear so, because certainly when Tim Carter arrived in this country to do the digging to find out what was actually going on, he had to have had contact with members of the People's Temple locally. They had to know precisely what he was doing and why he was doing the things he was doing.
Jackie, do you think we ever will get to the bottom of just exactly what and why, more importantly, why what happened at Fort Kajuma and at Jonestown occurred?
I'm alive today, and if I have any ability to see that that happens, I will. There have to be open public hearings on this, on a congressional level. I see no relevance in having executive hearings in Washington. That's just another document, in effect. If it's not going to be a public hearing, if it's not going to be a public airing of what State Department is doing and what it didn't do prior to that trip and since then in terms of implementing new recommendations, we're setting ourselves up for this happening again.
Would you like to see the likes of Mark Lane and Charles Gary called before those hearings and put
absolutely
on the road?
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely.
At the Jonestown site, survivors described a group of Jones followers who were allowed to carry weapons and money and to come and go from the camp. These people were also white, mostly males. They ate better and worked less than the others, and they served as armed guard to enforce discipline, control labor, and restrict movement. Among them were Jones' top lieutenants, George Philip Blakey, and others who regularly visited Georgetown, Guyana, and made trips in their seagoing boat to Cujo. Blakely was privileged to be on board the boat when the murders occurred. This special armed guard survived the massacre. Many were trained and programmed killers, like the zombies who attacked Ryan. Some were used as mercenaries in Africa and elsewhere. The dead were 90% women, 80% black. It's unlikely the men armed with guns and modern crossbows would give up control and willingness to be injected with poison. It is much more likely that they forced nearly 400 people to die by injection and then assisted in the murder of 500 more who attempted to escape. One survivor clearly heard people cheering 45 minutes after the massacre. Despite government claims, they are not accounted for, nor is their location known. This poem's called Bushwhacker Sam. Sam hightailed back to Kansas in his J.C. Penney suit, wearing yesterday's misfortune like a crown. Once he had a future full of neoliberal schemes, which he spent like they were going out of style. Now he keeps on whacking brush on his 40-acre farm, searching for a shrine he never found, never proving capitalism was a blessing but a curse. The counting cash was worth the selling out. 'Cause he's a preacher, he's a banker, he's a cowboy with a canker, riding shot off every lot on a trail of broken homes. He's a real-life carpet bagger, gun for hire, with a swagger. Bushwhacker Sam, you locked us up, now we'll burn those prisons down. He has tasted good and evil with Jeff Sessions and Bill Barr. He's traded your tomorrow for today, running with his devil Don, dancing on your scars, losing all the folks along the way. But the world keeps right on churning, not more better, far more worse. All he ever gets is fatter every day. from the foreclosed farmhouse shutters to the rolling of the hearse, the counting cash was worth the selling out. Because he's a preacher, he's a banker, he's a cowboy with a canker, riding shot off every lot on a trail of broken homes. He's a real-life carpet bagger, gun for hire with a swagger. Bushwhacker Sam, you locked us up. Now we'll burn those prisons down.